tell you, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
So you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
Hi, this is Rob Johnson. I'm back with Jayadi Ghosh for the second part of our conversation on the current developments as of the fourth quarter of 2020 related to the COVID crisis. In this segment, we're going to talk about the COVID vaccine, the international process of producing and disseminating it to help extinguish the role of COVID-19. Jayadi, please, you've written a couple of very interesting articles about the process, about the intellectual property rights, about the inequality of distribution that may be on the horizon. So why don't you paint the picture of what you see as the challenge that we face at this juncture.
I think it's good news that some vaccines have already been developed and are already actually being distributed. And there's a lot of excitement I can see in the United States and in the UK, where some vaccines produced by Pfizer are already being distributed to vulnerable and in populations who are more exposed. But the trouble is that this is really only confined to a few lucky advanced countries, and of course, a very small proportion of those. And most of the world is actually excluded from this. So it's confirming some fears that many people had, that even when you develop a vaccine, it's not really going to solve the problem because wealthy countries and rich people will basically monopolize the early doses. And this will add to the inequality because it means that across the world, populations will remain at risk and the economies will continue to suffer because of the pandemic, while some countries will secure their own doses and really not bother about everyone else. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. And of course, it makes no sense when you think about it, because a pandemic is a global phenomenon. It doesn't have a passport. It doesn't look for visas. And so everybody is at risk as long as anyone in the world is unprotected. But somehow, this basic fact has not been recognized, even though the international community actually made preparations for a more just and equitable outcome. There is something called COVAX, the Vaccines Global Access Facility, the COVID-19 Vaccines Global Access Facility, and it's led by the World Health Organization, the Vaccine Alliance Gavi, and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness. So what was the idea behind COVAX? It was that we'll incentivize vaccine development by providing money to different companies that are trying to develop it, secure doses for all countries, and distribute the doses fairly, beginning with the highest risk groups. So, in fact, you would have two phases of distribution. In the first phase, everybody will get doses up to 3% of their population. And the idea is that you would then distribute it to those who are at highest risk, frontline workers in health and social care, extremely elderly populations, and so on. And then you keep giving additional doses until 20% of the population is immunized, beginning with the elderly, those with comorbidities, and all of that. In the second phase, you then deliver only to specific countries based on how quickly the virus is spreading, or whether there are other pathogens, say measles or something, or whether the country's health infrastructure is very vulnerable. Now, this is actually a pretty fair system. It's hard to think of a more just system. So far, it seemed very promising. There were 150 countries that participated, about 2/3 of the population. The United States did not participate, of course. Donald Trump's government refused. But 64 high-income countries and 92 low-income countries, a bunch of other middle-income and emerging markets, and so on. The 92 low-income countries were supposed to get their doses free of charge. And that would be paid for by people who would, by the governments and other institutions that would pay in to the COVAX facility to enable them to distribute these vaccines to the poorest populations. It needs, I think, about $2 billion has been committed, but only about $700 million has been provided to the COVAX facility so far. So it sounds good. But the trouble is that the COVAX facility did not prevent governments who joined it from doing side deals. And that's precisely what has happened. That the major advanced countries, the governments have actually done the side deals. The European Union for just the Pfizer vaccine, the European Union has already pre-purchased 300 million doses. The United States has a population of only 320, but it ordered first 100 million doses and another 500 it has the rights on. So 600 million doses. Brazil tried to get some, but individual countries, the United Kingdom has got, I think, 40 million doses immediately and another set coming. So basically, within days of when they announced that they have done this and that it's and it was working with, I think, 94% success rate, Pfizer had sold more than 80% of all the doses it can produce in the whole of 2021 to governments that account for less than 15% of the world's population. So what does that mean? It means that if this is the safe and effective vaccine, most of the world will never get it for the next year. In fact, there are other candidates, of course. There is the Moderna vaccine, which has already, again, a lot of countries have already cut deals for privileged access. There's AstraZeneca. Again, many countries have already done deals independent of COVAX. What does this mean? It means that if you're looking at the vast majority of the world, the governments of those countries are not going to be able to get access to distribute to their populations until 2023, in some cases, 2 years ahead. So we are talking about a huge inequality being perpetrated just in terms of how many people will be able to access a vaccine that should be a fundamental right for anyone on the planet. This is appalling for many reasons, but one of the most important reasons for why this is appalling is because it's not necessary. It's not just that you had the COVAX facility. It is that these are companies that are still maintaining their patents, their intellectual property rights over these vaccines, over how they're made, how they're developed, and all of the attendant knowledge, even though most of this knowledge was developed with public money. The Moderna vaccine, apparently, it's already been fully paid for. All the costs are covered. Around 80% of Pfizer's costs are covered. AstraZeneca, most of its costs have been covered already. Yet they are insisting that they will be able to charge governments for this vaccine, which I think is unacceptable. Yet that's really what's happening. And we are in a situation where attempts by the developing countries, India, South Africa, a bunch of other developing countries, I think there were seven of them, they put a case in the WTO, in the World Trade Organization, saying during this period of the pandemic, we have to suspend intellectual property rights, effectively issue compulsory licenses for the production of these vaccines. This was immediately opposed by the United States, by most of the countries in the European Union, by Switzerland, you know, all of the usual suspects, basically. And they are blocking any attempt to actually make sure that there are no special patent privileges given during the pandemic.
So how would I say, capitalism is operating in the trenches where if you can find an inelastic demand curve, you can hold somebody up and get a lot of money. But part of what we have in society, for instance, are rules and laws and regulations that diminish that exploitation. But in this global system, we don't have what you might call a common platform. And so this, which you might call immoral tug of war, is allowed to play itself out. What can we do? What can we do to, I guess I'm gonna be a little bit silly, but if I was an airline executive, I would be a huge advocate for global dissemination of the vaccine to everyone so that I could start flying planes and resuming which you might call providing a service to people who are now in the countries that don't get the vaccine. They're going to be locked down, and we're not going to let them into the places that do have the vaccine. We're segmenting the world in a lot of dimensions, more than just the horrid immorality of the extinguishment of the disease. Why are we in such a place of what you might call cruelty and narrowness of imagination? How is this playing out?
You know, you're so right, because it's not just narrow and cruel, it's stupid. It's exactly that. It is that you are, in fact, undoing your own possibilities for economic revival, for societal integration, for everything by doing this. So here's the thing. It doesn't need to happen. The developed country governments that are opposing the elimination of the patents, they are not representing the interests of their citizens. Most citizens in the United States, in UK, in Switzerland, in Germany, in France, they would all be fine if this happened, because it would mean a faster production of the vaccine. It could be produced all over the world. You could import it. Everybody would get it within the next year, within the next 6 months even. So it would be in the interests of all the citizens. The only agents that it favors are the multinational drug companies. So governments are not representing the interests of their citizens. They are basically representing here only the pharma lobbies in the WTO, and they are able, therefore, to actually stop what is an eminently logical and obvious solution. Now, this can't happen. This should not happen in what are at least called democracies. We should not allow a few big multinational drug companies to get away with enforcing something which is against the interests of all the people on the planet. So I think what we can do is generate much more awareness of what is going on. I don't think too many people even know that this is what is happening. We should demand, citizens of the United States should demand for the government that they actually should stop opposing this in the WTO. And similarly, citizens in Europe and everywhere. And they're not necessarily being kind and good to the developing world. They are being good to themselves. It's something that makes eminent sense for everybody. Everyone would benefit if the vaccines that are being developed were more generally available and were available cheaply. So it's one of those situations where it's not just the anarchy of capitalism. It is broadly the ability of really moribund capitalism to enforce the lobbying power it has over the state in ways that damage its own long-term interests, because it's not in the interests of these companies even to have dead economies for very long.
The last segment that Seth Klein, Naomi Klein's brother, wrote a book. It's called The Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. And the very point that he made in that book in relation to climate springs up in my imagination as I'm listening to you now, because what they're essentially saying is when something is imperative and has to be done, you don't just lay back and wait for the market or whatever to do it. You command, in that case, we're going to start building vehicles and tanks, etc., to create the equipment because we have to go to war. In this instance, he's talking about climate, but here in talking about the disease, just allowing this public good to not be a public good feels like it's on the border of criminal. And I see these arguments in some of the papers, including those you've written and others who've commented, where people are saying, well, you're destroying the incentives that the intellectual property rights protection creates. But how much risk have these companies taken with massive amounts of public funding for the creation of the vaccine? Are any of them losing money?
In fact, Pfizer and Moderna have already made up their entire investment. So there's no risk at all. Everything else they get is now extra cream. There's nothing that they are risking at all at this point. These are all just extra benefits. And this is the trouble that, you know, across the world, there are all these companies that have benefited hugely from government subsidies to produce the vaccine because it was seen as so critically important for public health. Now, if that's the case, what have they said? What is their agreement with the government? Oh, we won't charge you that much more. We'll charge you a bit less than we would have charged otherwise. How is that even a thing? I mean, this is really a situation where you have you've created incentives for them, you've provided resources for their R&D, and you've provided markets for them. You're doing everything. And then they say, well, you know, we have to also charge you very high prices because we're doing this great thing. And it's scarce at the moment. And we'll have differential pricing for different countries, which is what most of these companies are also saying, the slightly lower rate in India and so on, which suggests that they are doing this segmented pricing because they know it's a monopoly, because they know countries are desperate, and because they can get away with it. What's happening is that citizens of the world are allowing governments to bring in a system where these companies can get away with it at the cost of lives. Because remember, the longer it takes for these vaccines to get across to the entire population, the more lives will be lost, the more people will suffer from this disease, the more health systems will be terribly, terribly battered, the more people will have to actually endure all kinds of other impacts of the disease in different ways over time. All of this is unnecessary. And all of this is just to provide extra rents, extra monopoly rents to pharma companies who have already benefited from state subsidy of their investment.
So what you'd mentioned numbers, like I remember reading 13% of the world's population would have access in the first year. How is the vaccine, I mean, unless it's absolutely bulletproof, how is the vaccine going to make a major contribution to the tailing off of the spread of the virus if only 13% of the world's population has it?
This is, you see, essentially what it would do. A vaccine cannot give you the kind of herd immunity that is talked about until you have about 60% of the population vaccinated, inoculated. But what's happening here is that certain countries that represent 14% of the population, they have already grabbed the first year's supply of the Pfizer vaccine and about 60% of the first year supply of the Moderna vaccine. So they're basically grabbing the supplies and cornering the market before. So that means in the first year, some countries will get this amount and they will be able to vaccinate significant proportions of their own populations. The most of the world will be left waiting unless other vaccines get developed in the meantime. There are some promising candidates. There's a Chinese vaccine, which apparently has worked rather well in the Middle East. There is a Cuban vaccine, which doesn't get talked about much, but that will be the best option for developing countries if it does work, because that is not going to carry a huge patent cost. That is going to be made available cheaply, and that will actually not be under intellectual property rights. So it could be produced on a mass scale in other parts of the world. But that tells you something. It's a Cuban vaccine. That tells you that, in fact, it's a company that will not be operating on these purely profit-oriented and, let's say, rapacious principles during a pandemic. And it will be supported by a government that is happy with a company that is behaving in this desirable way. Whereas advanced country governments are supporting companies and, in fact, thanking them and saying, oh, we're so grateful to you, Pfizer, and oh, thank you, Moderna, when they've actually paid for the whole thing. And then they're allowing them to go and make excess profit on this and to limit the production, not allow this thing to be produced in other countries, because then they want to keep their profits going. I think it's not just immoral and it's not just obscene, it's stupid. It is stupid because your economy will not grow if you're going to disallow the basic health that will enable you to engage in trade and tourism and international travel and all of the other things that modern economies rely on.
So I want to kind of try on a thought here. Let's say I'm purely selfish and I'm sitting somewhere in the United States and the vaccine is distributed, let's just say hypothetically, only in the United States. And in a place like India, because of the propagation of the disease, the distress, the stage of development, they, in coping, cannot for the next 4 or 5 years begin to address climate change. So by allowing the restriction on the dissemination, or even the non-subsidizing from taxpayers all over the world of broad-based dissemination, the transformation of the carbon economy is retarded, has very adverse consequences, including the air that I breathe. And secondly, the depth and the duration of the global recession, depression, the use of fiscal capacity to try to sustain us through this very long and deep exercise, it feels like what I would say is the right global social choice, not just from the standpoint of the collective or goodness, but for me, for my own lungs, for my own health, sitting in the United States is a much broader dissemination of the vaccine and a much larger movement to create, I would say, the numbers of production and the distribution all over the world. Am I missing something?
You're absolutely right. You know, it does, even if you are somebody sitting in, you know, the central part of the United States who is not planning to travel abroad, is only going to be staying within his or her locality, you can protect yourself, yes. But as long as you allow this disease to proliferate and the pandemic to continue, your economy will be affected because we're all interdependent now. Your ability perhaps to even keep your job will be affected. Your environment will be affected, as you mentioned. The climate change pattern will be affected. And so it's impossible. And there's and what is so sort of alarming in this is that it really is not necessary. It is so easy to just change the system. And let me also just point out that, you know, it's not something very radical and crazy that is being suggested here. When the WTO was formed in the TRIPS agreement, the agreement on trade-related intellectual property rights, one of the clauses that was very clearly in there was that for compulsory licensing. And compulsory licensing was actually designed to ensure that the fact of a patent doesn't give monopoly rights and doesn't operate against the social interest. This was underlined once again in 2003 in the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health, where it said very clearly that compulsory licensing can be and should be invoked when there is a public health concern, when there is an epidemic, is the term that used there, which affects a significant part of the population. In fact, only 7% had to be vulnerable to it. And now we have the whole globe vulnerable to it. And then you impose a compulsory license. Now, what is that? That is simply saying that whoever has produced this technology has to make it available to other producers with a certain royalty, some reasonably fair royalty in return. But other producers should be allowed to make it so that you get enough of this to make it quickly available to meet the health needs of everyone. Now, this was something that was already seen in 2003. If ever there was a case for instituting compulsory licensing, it is for these vaccines. It's unbelievable that this is still something on which the intellectual property rights are being imposed, and that all the advanced country governments are lining up to prevent this compulsory licensing idea from being extended. It's unbelievable, because they are going against the interests of their own people, and they're only helping the big drug companies.
I'm kind of remembering the echoes. I once went to Tanzania, and I took a novel by John le Carré that was called The Constant Gardener. And it was essentially about the, which you might call the trading of intellectual property rights, and how a gentleman learns that his wife was dead and somehow had been murdered, but it gets into the whole question of what is humane and what is malpractice on the part of major pharmaceutical companies. I don't know. I thought when I read that novel, it was, you know, fiction with a capital F. But it almost feels like that's the story that's playing out now. How would you say? Maybe John le Carré was illuminating something that was much more dangerous than I was able to perceive when I read the novel. And I think it was something, let's see, I took my children then, so they were, must have been around 2001 or 2002 that he wrote that book. But that was a time where, whether it was tuberculosis or whatever, it was cruel curtail the dissemination and allow people to extract excess profit. But this feels like what you might call all hands on deck emergency for planet Earth. And we're not rising above that structure that le Carré could see was already damaging. Are you hopeful that we're going to learn and respond constructively, or are you skeptical as to whether we can rise to this challenge?
I think this time may be different. You know, I mean, I think le Carré got his finger on it, but part of the reason his novels are so good is because he really does capture a lot of underlying reality. But the world has been through this before. With HIV/AIDS, we had a very similar thing. It didn't get the same public resonance. We still had companies trying to profit off, restricting access to life-saving drugs. And there were countries, South Africa and Kenya and so on, that had to fight very, long cases to actually ensure that they would get these drugs at a reasonable price. And it was the same kind of thing. But then it didn't have the same public resonance because, let's face it, a small proportion of the population was affected by HIV/AIDS in the advanced countries. In Africa, it was much more widespread, but it didn't affect the rich countries quite so much. Now we have everybody in the rich world affected. And in fact, death rates are much higher in the advanced economies than they are in most developing countries for some reason that nobody has figured out yet. But if now, even now, people fall for this, and I think a lot of this is simply because Big Pharma has major lobbying power and Big Pharma also has big power to control media. I think enough people don't know about this. Enough people don't know how much their own interests are being harmed by government protection of IPRs during this pandemic, in ways which are completely unjustified, because these companies have already been fully paid for their investment. They've already got, they've covered everything they've spent. They've already got basic profit on it. And then to be allowed to make super profits and restrict access and restrict the production of this essential life-saving item simply because they want to and because they can. That's unbelievable. I mean, if somebody came down from Mars and saw that this is what we were doing, they would say, my God, this planet is crazy and it's not going to last for very long. So there's no point being very interested in it. If we can be so stupid about something so simple and obvious as this need to eliminate intellectual property for life-saving drugs during a pandemic, when the drug's cost has already been covered, then how are we going to cope with the really existential challenges posed by climate change, which are going to demand much greater solidarity, much greater cohesion, much greater public spending? So I think this time might be different, if only because people, I still believe that humanity can't be that dumb and we will step back from the brink. And I think right now with the case of drugs, if there's sufficient public pressure, and let's face it, all it needs is for the US government to change its mind. And that will pretty much bring everyone else back into line, given the way global power is structured. If there's enough public pressure in the US, you might still get a change in this.
Yeah, I think what you say is illuminating. And for more and more people to understand this and scrutinize makes a great deal of sense. I know at INET, I made a podcast a little earlier this year with a man about his working paper for INET. His name was Fred Ledley on, I think it was called How U.S. Taxpayers Subsidized Pharma Research and How the Companies Reaped the Profit. And it was related to 10 years of empirical study on what drugs were produced and upstream, how they all got funded. And the taxpayers were paying, but a lot of people don't have the means to have access, and that's even within the United States. So this question of the relationship of individual property rights to what you might call collective property rights feels like an enormous challenge. And it's an enormous challenge in relation to climate, and it's an enormous challenge in relation to health systems. And how much do you think we suffer from what you might call the era of globalization, creating a confusion about where governance is between the nation state on the one hand, locality on the second, and what I might call a level playing field of world rules in the third? Are we kind of in a limbo, in a transition zone here where we haven't sorted out things that really do apply at the global level?
I would put it slightly differently. I think, you know, it's not just globalization. I think this is really now an economic system. I mean, the kind of neoliberal capitalism that we have, which is so finance dependent and which is so driven by the interests of large capital over everybody else, I think this has really now run out of steam in very many crucial ways. And essentially, it's been, in a way, too successful for its own good in terms of demolishing all adversaries. It's demolished the power of labor unions. It's demolished the power of regulators. It's demolished the power of, you know, associations of citizens who would, you know, protest about things. It's basically got rid of any rivals or anybody who could stand in its way. And now that it's got rid of all of that, it runs out of steam. It's defunct. It's not able. I mean, to do the kind of innovation and so on that has been talked about, which is excellent in terms of delivering outcomes for the pandemic, you had to have public investment. It wasn't that they rushed out and did it. It was governments giving them money, saying, take all this money. First of all, take the results of our research, which we have done in our public labs for the last 20 years. Take all those results. Take all these millions of dollars and quickly find me a vaccine. Now, frankly, that's not capitalism. So capitalism in a dynamic sense is dead. Unfortunately, there's no one to move the dead body out of the way. That's our problem. We're kind of covered by this shroud, which is no longer actually useful in terms of organizing our economies. And we have to now bring back the regulation, the recognition of the importance of public spending, the importance and necessity of redistribution. We have to bring all of those back to actually create a viable economic system again. I don't think what we have at the moment is viable.
How would you suggest how would I say, these critiques be elevated? Do we need a forum? How do we gain credibility for experts again? The notion that experts were essentially doing marketing for the wealthy and powerful caused an awful lot, I know at least in American society, a lot of people to tune out on experts because they didn't think they were providing for the global public good. They thought they were providing, what you might call, pandering to power and furthering their own career and pretending to be providing for the public good. How do we, what you might call, create that focal point now where these tragedies of action, not just tragedies that we're responding to, these tragedies of action are so deficient. But rather than just breeding despondency and perhaps what you might call oiling the gears for authoritarianism, how do we bring expertise back to light and re-engender trust in it? Because I think that cynicism is often what deters the enthusiasm for collective action.
Yes, you're right. And of course, another complication now is that there seem to be alternative realities. I mean, people can persuade themselves about anything, right? So the world has changed in funny ways that there can be whole groups of people who can think that an election outcome was actually different from what it was. That there can be people who think that, you know, no matter what my government has done to me, it actually is nonetheless doing it for my own best interest. And it doesn't matter that I take all the pain and the rich get all the gain. So there are alternative realities out there. But I think, you know, the distrust of expertise has some basis. I think we have to recognize that. And I think economists, especially, you know, the mainstream, has a lot to answer for in this. Because we have had economists who are always presenting themselves as experts who are, you know, technocrats beyond the, you know, not really open to any questioning because they understand something that the ordinary person cannot. And there's been a lot of that. And people, I think, are right to be mistrustful and even angry about that kind of thing. But the way to counter that, therefore, is not to come and say, listen, I'm an expert, I know more than you, and I know better than you. It is to actually put the facts on the table, to tell them about what is going on. How many people in the United States even know that Moderna and Pfizer, the money that they spent on creating this vaccine has been largely provided by the state, by governments in the European Union and in the United States? How many people in the country know that? I bet not that many people. How many know that any other money they get in producing this is just surplus profits? It's excess beyond the regular profits that most companies would expect. How many know that a patent allows them to keep the monopoly control of even producing this so that even after they've got all these profits, they can prevent other companies from producing it at a price at which everybody could access it without taxpayers' money having to subsidize it further? Not many people know these things. So we don't have to present it as, you know, we are experts and so on. We just have to say, here's this information that you need to know as a citizen. And you need to go out there and tell your state, tell your government, tell your whoever it is, your congressman or whatever, that this can't go on, that the government should stop supporting this kind of regime, which allows companies to profit in a completely unacceptable and unnecessary way. And the argument that it will stifle innovation, I think, is complete nonsense. There's a lot of excellent work by Mariana Mazzucato and her team that shows so much innovation is actually public sector driven. And so much of it is the kind of thing that the blue sky thinking that forms the basis for a lot of the new stuff, comes from long, patient investment in public institutions, which allow for that to mature and develop over time. And then someone can come in the last mile and take the benefit of that to produce a new thing that, you know, is socially useful.
Well, Jody, I think, how would I say, the light that you're shining is extraordinary. And I was thinking about, I mentioned feeling the spirit of Nina Simone in our last episode. Yes. And as I listen to you today, talking about these challenges and what to do, not just lamenting what's wrong, but how to rise to the challenge, I was reminded by, there's a famous album called Nuff Said. It was a live album that Nina Simone made just after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. I think, just a few days. And she wrote a song called Why the King of Love is Dead. And that was a lament. But the next song that she wrote, included in the album, and the one that became most popular, had come from a musical that was celebrating what you might call the counterculture and the hippies in a musical called Hair. And she did a medley of a song called I Ain't Got No with another song called I've Got Life. In this period where the intellectual architecture and the confidence and the trust has been so devastated, what I most appreciate in listening to you is that it infuses in me the feeling like I've got life. I've got a purpose. I got something to strive for. It's not a time for despondency. And I hope that you will continue to work with the Young Scholars Initiative at INET, because that kind of example is what they say, what the doctor ordered for the disease of our time. And I'm not just talking about COVID-19. I'm talking about putting the psychological pieces back together. But thank you so much.
No, I have to say, I always all my interactions with the Young Scholars Initiative have made me feel so much more positive and optimistic about the future. I think there are some terrific elements out there which are really dynamic and progressive and full of beans and full of spunk. So I think there's a lot of hope there.
Yeah, and with 16,000 members at this juncture, mm-hmm. following their recent virtual plenary, there's a virtual army of people to carry on the vision and the mission that doctors like you prescribe for society. But I just want to thank you again.
Thank you.
This was another vital and, illuminating discussion, inspiring discussion. And I look forward to getting together again with you soon.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start singing. And I'll know my song well before I start singing.